Spokesman Mike Pina.
The bottom line is that gas prices are high, but it's still the least expensive way for a group of people to travel.
The Alliance to Save Energy offers some gas saving tips that include renting a hybrid, performing basic auto maintenance if needed, decreasing your speed to below 60 miles an hour, driving during non-peak times, and considering public transportation at your vacation spot. Trina Williams, NPR News, Washington.
The backlog of unsold homes is getting bigger. The National Association of Realtors says sales of single-family homes dropped by 1% in April. It was the eighth decline in 9 months. The median price for an existing home has also dropped 8.5%. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from sitforless.com, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including the new color, True Black. Sitforless.com.
News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Before you head out on vacation, join us on Friday, June 6th for our first annual summer celebration on AM 580. Get in the summer spirit and help us reach our June 30th fundraising goal with your pledge of support.
This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. Across the country, state finances are deteriorating. According to a report from the National Conference of State Legislatures, most state budgets for the current fiscal year were based on revenue forecasts that have not developed as expected. 16 states have reported shortfalls. All told, these budget gaps total close to $12 billion. And things for fiscal 2009, that's the fiscal year that for many states will begin on July 1st, things certainly don't look any better. In fact, things look worse. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about what states are doing to try to stay in the black. And our guest is Todd Donovan. He's professor of political science at Western Washington University. That's in Bellingham, Washington. He teaches and does research on American state politics and policy, and he's been good enough to spend some time with us here this morning talking about this particular subject. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of people who call in with the questions is just that they try to keep their questions short and comments brief so that we can get as many people in as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good. Anywhere that you can hear us, that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call, and we'd be very happy to bring you into the conversation again. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and a toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Donovan, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Just as a way of, you know, sometimes we on this program, we say jokingly our motto is, it's the show that asks how bad is it? So let's start out and talk about it, how bad it is. And apparently it is looking indeed serious. As I said, I think these numbers come from the National Conference of State Legislatures. That's where I get this figure that there are 16 states with budget gaps, and then others have made sort of estimates talking about what things look like for the next fiscal year that's not all that far away. And they say 23 states are expecting budget deficits. There's another estimate, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says
20 states on their list.
Oh, that's even two more than what mine was 27. So it seems like indeed this is a very serious. It's serious now, and it's likely that it's going to get worse.
Yeah, unless you're in a state that's pumping a lot of oil out of the ground or is benefiting by the resource mineral boom, it's looking pretty grim. It's a moving target too. Every time, you know, if you go track down news stories on this, every month it gives you a state's forecast, and it gets worse and it gets worse. So the odds are most states, the vast majority of them, are dealing with having to come up with hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars for fiscal year 2009. the problem you mentioned earlier is there's a lot of them that are still scrambling to make things add up between now and the end of June.
Yeah, for the and this certainly this state is one of them, where just a couple of months ago, they as at that point, the legislature was wrestling with the budget for the next. The next fiscal year, that and we're one of those states where the fiscal year starts on July 1st, whether they're now currently arguing about that year, but the, a couple of months ago, more than a couple of months ago perhaps, the state treasurer and the budget people were saying, hey, we got a deficit right now. We can't meet current bills. So here it's a serious problem, and a lot of other places a serious problem. And as you say, they're trying to just to meet current expenses as they're trying to think about how it is that they're going to meet the expenses in the next fiscal year, the one that hasn't even started yet.
Yeah, and that's the bigger problem is going to be next year, and the short term trying to get through the next couple of months maybe makes people lose focus on that. But as bad as things are in Illinois, I mean you're. Maybe one of the 10 worst states in terms of the proportion of the budget that's going to be out of whack. There are several that are far worse off even than Illinois.
Well, that'll make us feel better. Where are things the worst?
Like I said, Illinois probably cracks the top 10, but the worst are Florida, Arizona, California, Nevada, and then maybe New York and Rhode Island. It all kind of depends how you define bad. I mean, I'm looking at it as, these are states that have at least 10% of the projected 2009 shortfall. The deficit that they're facing is equal to 10% or more of their budget. And, you can look at that. That might not look like a lot of dollars in Rhode Island, but, it's the California deficit is projected to be larger than most states' single-year budget. So, and the reasons are different across all these states, and it kind of gives you a sense of how the recession is playing out nationally to look at, why Florida's got their particular problems or why Nevada's got their particular problems. But, but Illinois is up there. I mean, they're looking at one of the projections I saw is for 2009, they might have $1.8 billion, which the way things usually go, it gets worse. That's going to be $2 billion by the time they get around looking to it.
Yeah. Well, Ed, as you mentioned, all states are not suffering, and particularly those states that have energy industry working in their states and generating income. The states like Alaska, for example,
yeah.
they're doing okay.
You'll get money back if you're a resident in the state of Alaska.
Well, they're actually looking at a budget surplus in Alaska. They're doing so well.
Yeah, the oil revenues.
Oil revenues, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last
one. I was just agreeing. Exactly. That's what it is for them. And then there are other places. I think North Dakota, Wyoming, Louisiana, they're doing okay, at least.
And even South Dakota, Texas, New Mexico, they've got mineral revenues coming in. A lot of those states, they've always benefited from the resource revenues, but then they've also suffered when the price of oil, the price of coal or something goes down. But they're all riding pretty high right now. And so, when you look at a state like Alaska, they don't need an income tax. They've got a permanent dividend fund every year. So if the oil revenues are good, you get a couple thousand bucks back as a resident of Alaska. The only other states that are looking, maybe solidly healthy would have a very, vibrant agricultural sector that's maybe, a huge proportion of the state's economy. Nebraska, Kansas aren't looking too bad. And some of the Pacific Northwest states, they're in balance at least, which relative doesn't make them look that bad. But for the most part, the politics in every state for the next year or so is going to be how to come up with the revenues to balance things out.
Well, there are economists who are debating this question of, is the U.S. economy in recession or not, and is it? And if not, is it headed that way? There are some people, I think, that they're arguing that already there are some states that are in recession. Even if the nation isn't, there are some states that are. And clearly there's links between the health of state economies and the health of the economy in general of the country. So if you ask this question, look at those places where things are really bad, like Illinois and California and Florida. Is that, can you say that that's the result of poor planning in those states, or does it have more to do with what's happening nationally, and that this kind of significant decline in state revenues was maybe not something that you could have forecast or planned for?
It's probably a bit of yes for both of those. I mean, a national recession is nothing more than the sum of all the economic activity in various states, and it's clear, certainly, that some states are really suffering now. They've been in recession, and, you know, they're forecasting conservative revenue increases or how much taxes are going to come in, and they're not even meeting how much sales tax revenue projections they're going to make. You know, Florida, Arizona, these places are suffering more than the national economy. So, you know, that could you plan for it? The problem with a lot of states, California is maybe the worst case example of this, but Rhode Island, some of the other states are in big trouble. Their revenues are very cyclical, especially these sales tax-driven revenues. And, you know, right now when the economy is cooling off, those revenues go down, you make cuts. But at the same time, when those revenues go up, or just tax revenues generally, states have a tendency to then really kind of feast on these windfalls, and they set themselves up for, you know, an inevitable decline that's going to happen. So a lot of states really ramped up spending in the years leading up to 2001, and there's, you know, and things stabled off or they've cooled, and now we've really got a downturn. And, you know, they know that sales tax revenues and corporate income tax revenues and revenues from capital gains and stocks and stuff, those things are going to be highly cyclical. So in some ways, you set yourself up for a fall when you depend heavily on those revenues and ramp up a lot of programs when they're coming in strong.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Todd Donovan. He is professor of political science at Western Washington University, and that is in Bellingham, Washington. He's there in the Department of Political Science, is interested in state politics, American state and local politics, and we're talking here about state budget issues across the country. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, when you have the kind of problems that we're talking about here, where you have states that have deficits now, and they're looking ahead to fiscal 2009, and things don't look good, and I think we said now 29 states are saying that they're expecting to have problems in the coming fiscal year, and we're looking at budget gaps that total something like $39 billion, and it could be more. Two-thirds of the states say that they are worried about fiscal 2009. So if you ask, well, what are you going to do? There are two alternatives. You can raise revenue, you can cut spending. Let's talk about the spending side. What are some states doing to try to trim their spending?
Okay, but the states will find more than those two options, so we should come back to that.
Oh, okay.
The creative things that states can do besides just, you know, cutting and raising taxes.
Cutting, raise taxes. Okay.
But when you cut, I mean, that's the obvious thing that really has to happen for a lot of states, and it depends on the political will. You know, I mean, some states are actually trying to at least continue through with the same level of services. New York is one of those. Others are going to cut a lot, potentially, like Florida. But you got to cut the big spending areas, the vast, you know, if some people talk about, we'll just cut 10% across the board, well, then that really doesn't make any difference, and, you know, your parks budget is cut 10%. That's not going to get you out of the hole. So the biggest cuts are going to hit the biggest spending areas, which are health care, social services, and education. And, you know, there's really, if you're going to make cuts, there's no way to avoid that. Hmm. So, you know, the number of beneficiaries in children health, child health programs, how much you're going to pay home health care workers, how much states are going to compensate local districts for per pupil costs for education. Those are the big things that end up getting cut.
Let's just for a second turn to the tax side, and of course that's never going to be a popular thing, and in fact there are some states, there actually are states that have no income taxes, and there are some states that don't have sales taxes, so raising them is not an option if you don't have them.
Right.
But what are states looking at, and are they continuing to try to find those taxes that are going to be the least objectionable? For example, in New York, they now have the highest cigarette tax in the entire country. They made a big increase in the tax on cigarettes, which does not fall equally on everybody, and maybe that's the way to minimize the pain. But it seems like it's never going to be a popular thing. No legislator is ever going to want to stand up and say,
I raised your taxes,
yeah, right. Obviously.
Yeah, well, so you call it a fee. You know, states, again, they're very creative, and it depends on the politics of the state. But if taxes are raised, You know, you see very creative use of sales tax increases. You know, we'll target certain types of vehicles, or we will target cigarettes, sin taxes. One of the ones in California that's proposed seriously to raise close to $1 billion is a 25% tax on pornography. In other years, you know, Minnesota came up with a way to tax the possession of marijuana. You get really creative in these sorts of times, but you know, the more it can be targeted to some demographic that people don't necessarily care too much about, the more that's maybe something that's going to fly. But what you'll also see more likely over recent years is you raise fees. So you raise your college tuition. If there's something that the state can provide that you can charge direct fees for, you raise those fees. So you're bringing in more revenues, but you don't have to call it a tax increase. So cigarettes, gasoline, those sorts of things are the internet sales that have been left untaxed. You know, this is the time now where you're starting to see a lot of states going, well, we got to figure out ways to tap into this stuff. So you don't necessarily raise your sales tax across the board. You just find lots of different ways to apply it.
Can you make a lot of money by taxing pornography?
There's somebody in the California legislature, and you know, the amount of money they got to come up with there is incredible, right? Mm-hmm. But apparently, I saw this at a press conference saying, this is one of the biggest industries in the country, multi-billion-dollar industry. It is headquartered in California. They should tax it. But, you know, then now you've got the industry lobbyists. They have lobbyists, right? They're going to go up to Sacramento, make their case that it'll be taxed too many times. At what level do you tax them? When do you define pornography? But, no, they were talking close to $1 billion. I think that might have been annually. That would be the classic or ultimate example, maybe, of here's a tax that, you know, it's the sin tax, as we call it, the penultimate sin tax. Yeah. But, you know, more commonly it'd be on things like cigarettes, alcohol.
All right. Let's talk with a caller here, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have to wonder about the enormous waste in government. I'd like to cite two examples. Our governor does not live in the state capitol. He flies in from Chicago to Springfield, and I thought I read that it costs like $5,000 a round trip, and he stays an average of 4 hours. The second example of sheer waste comes from Representative Shane Cultra of Onarga, Cultra's Capital Clip, C-U-L-T-R-A. He mentions that the head of the Commission on Discrimination and Hate Crimes is paid $96,000 a year, but there haven't been any members appointed to the commission, and it hasn't held a meeting in 2 years. And I suspect that these two examples are but a minuscule portion of a much larger picture of inefficiency and waste. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, what do you think about that? And maybe not specifically those examples, but this idea that if you went through your budget really carefully, you would find ways to save money. And you might even be able to make the argument that that was a good thing.
Yeah, well, this has been, you know, the kind of classic fuel behind the anti-tax movements in states that have ballot initiatives in particular, where you know, citizens can directly propose tax cuts. They're criticized by saying, oh, you know, you don't want to get rid of any services, but you want to cut your taxes. You're looking for something for nothing. And then they'll come back saying, no, we can maintain the same level of services because there's all this waste and fat and inefficiencies that can be cut. It's hard to evaluate that, you know, because a lot of what government provides isn't necessarily something that you can look at in terms of the efficiencies of the market. But when you do see a lot of these tax cuts imposed by citizens, we don't have a lot of evidence that that necessarily systematically leads to reduction in public services, which makes you think, you know, okay, well, then they must be cutting some fat. But usually what it is that the government is creative, legislators and governors are creative, and they find alternate revenue sources. But in some states, there's been a movement to try to get much more rigorous auditing, mandated auditing of state agencies so we can shine the light on this stuff and actually figure that out.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. A little bit earlier, I said that if you have budget problems, that there are these two basic things that you can do. You can spend less, or you can do try to do whatever you can to raise revenue, which generally means taxes and fees. And then you said, and yet there is that, there just not two choices. There are some other things that you can do, perhaps things that are a little bit...
Yeah, there's maybe there's a third, fourth, and a fifth choice that you might see states going to before they start raising taxes. And, you know, so yeah, you can do spending cuts. But again, you know, depending on the political will and the kind of, you know, political leanings of the state, one thing which, you know, you may have a rainy day fund or reserve fund or whatever like that, so you'll see across a lot of states right now, is this a serious enough emergency for us to dip into our reserve funds? And typically those aren't going to be enough to get you out. It's a one-time solution. But so, you know, you're seeing that playing out right now in a lot of budget negotiations, is how far do you dip into those reserves? The other thing, I don't know if you call it a gimmick or not, that a lot of states have done, which I'm sure we'll see again a lot of creativity in the next budget cycle, is figuring out some kind of one-time windfall that you can come up with to get yourself out, at least in the short term. The governor of California has lots of proposals for this. I think your governor might have something similar to this, but issuing bonds to either cover previous budget allocations that haven't been met or things that would have come out of the general fund, or, you know, to dress it up as capital projects or something. But the California, they're just transparent about it. You know, we're calling these deficit bonds. We're going to issue $15 billion in bonds to fund the deficit. Or, you know, other examples like that would be, you've got a windfall of, the tobacco settlement money.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, securitize that, and somehow, you know, that's a future revenue stream. We'll sell bonds based on the anticipated revenues. Again, you know, going to California for all the ludicrous ideas, or I shouldn't call them ludicrous, but they're going to securitize and issue debt based on future lottery earnings. That's one proposal that might be on the ballot. But, you know, or try to figure out some way to get one-time windfalls from the federal government. So, you know, that can be a lot of wiggle room, that in reserves. And, you know, a third thing then even is, and lots of states have been doing this, and this sometimes just digs them into a deeper hole, are various accounting gimmicks. So, you know, a lot of what these deficits are forecasts. So you can, you know, forecast a revenue, and you can maybe be creative about how those forecasts are played out. Or getting, you know, the budget depends on certain cost of living increases that are mandated from, you know, previous years, getting rid of those, that changes the forecast about how much you have to spend. Suspending pension fund payments is a fairly common one. You know, not suspending, but deferring them, saying, you know, we'll do this in 2010 or 2012. So, you know, you play all those games, and the amount of spending cuts you might have to do can be dramatically, or tax increases then, or, you know, you might take a lot of that off the table in the short term.
And that, I'm sure, that kind of criticism has been made here, and it's made other places. That, yeah, that's, you can do that. You can do a combination of these things that are going to be relatively painless or touch few people. You can borrow money to try to carry you over. You can underfund your pension system like we are here, and that you can do that for a while.
Yeah.
But eventually, that's going to catch up with you. And by not taking the really hard, painful kind of step, you know, like maybe even talking seriously about a tax increase. And here, some years back, there were at least some people saying, you know, we've got this serious budget issue, and the best way, the real solid way to deal with it is with a tax increase, a temporary, you can say that it was temporary, but a temporary income tax increase. And that's just, stuff like that just doesn't fly.
It's very difficult politically. It you know, temporary sales tax increases are less politically challenging, and those have been floated around successfully. But yeah, temporary, and, you know, any kind of income tax thing, then people start. But yeah, a lot of it, again, it has to do with, you know, what's the political climate of the state. New York is a fairly liberal state, and you know they've got a sizable deficit. Florida is a more conservative state. You look at what's going on in New York politics right now; they're figuring out, you know, what are the creative things we can do to kind of keep things going as they are, or maybe even increase some spending for, you know, New York City schools or whatever. Florida, they're going to be, you know, shutting down university programs, laying off faculty, and they've got an $8 billion property tax cut proposed for the November ballot. So, you know, depending on the comfort level maybe of the state legislature, you know, and the willingness of voters to maybe tolerate a tax increase, you can get away with a lot more. But yeah, you got to couch it probably as a temporary thing. But, you know, that said, so there, you know, there are states where there will be tax increases.
So, well, I guess obviously this is requiring some kind of, something of a generalization, but would you say that in that there are most places that what they're hoping to do is by putting together little pieces like this, they're going to manage to limp along with the hope that one of these days the economy is going to turn around and it's going to all be better? Is that the more common approach? Or are
piece this thing together and hope that it kind of stays alive for a couple of years and then you get bailed out in good times. That's going to be more of the norm. But, you know, that might not seem how you or I or anyone would want to run their household budget, but the states are in a really odd position. If you look at it from the macroeconomic, you know, big picture kind of view, it's not like the federal government. You got to balance this budget out. But the irony here is, you know, what you want government to be doing in a recession from one kind of economic perspective would be that's when you don't want them cutting. You know, this is when the spending on the private sector is going down, so we want to stimulate the economy. We give people these, you know, $600 rebates from the IRS or whatever because you want that spending to go up. And that's maybe the worst time for states then to be, you start cutting back on, you know, all these projects the state would have been doing. Those vendors aren't getting paid. They're not, you know, you're depressing the economic activity in the state. And then on top of that, you add a tax increase in at the worst possible time when you want the economy to start picking up. So, there's that imperative, too. If you want to ramp back up the economy of Arizona, one of the last things you probably want to do is cut public spending and increase taxes. But, so, you know, in previous cycles, you'd then, all right, well, let's look to the federal government. This would be a good time for some kind of macroeconomic stabilization where the federal government could give one-time funds to bail states out in terms of, you know, the big thing driving a lot of the budget might be health care. Well, it is health care, you know, jointly operated with the federal government and state governments. Rather than giving everybody a $600 check that they're going to use to pay off their credit card bills, dump that money into maintaining spending levels in the state governments so that you kind of cushion the effect of the recession rather than amplify the effect of the recession by having the states cut programs and increase taxes.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll get to them in just a second, just as soon as I reintroduce our guest, Todd Donovan. He's professor of political science at Western Washington University in Bellingham. He is interested in his research in American state politics and policy, and we're talking about the budget difficulties that many states across the country are having and how it is from place to place they're trying to cope. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have caller in Sullivan. We'll talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, I have a statement here, two of them. One thing about the governor, if he wants to live other place besides the state capital, he ought to put his own way. That's my belief. But I'm calling on something I've called twice before, and that's a Chicago Board of Trade for Mercantile. Last year, or 2 years ago, they done $9 billion trades. This year, they done $9 billion, $200+ million trades. Now, I go out here and I buy stock in America, New York Stock Exchange, and it's $5.75 trade. It has went up 25 cents in the last 6 months. And the two economists, state economists on there around this time last year, and they commented that if they put the transaction fee on the trades at the Chicago Board of Trade, they'd move it. What's very interesting, they did not move the Chicago, New York or American trade. But, you know, if they just put $1 transaction fee in every trade, the state would have $200 million. That's a lot of money to piss away.
Well, I don't know. Professor Dunham, do you have any thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the relative, and the call was breaking up a bit on my end, but the relative cost of transaction on securities trades, New York versus Chicago, all that. But that is a huge revenue engine for New York. And, you know, I guess in boom years, 20% of state revenues are coming in from something to do with how the securities industry is taxed or have fees charged on them or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very lucrative source of revenues, potentially. But, again, it's just classic in terms of the kind of things that states tap into. It's highly cyclical. You get a recession, trading goes down or profits are going down or whatever, the activity is going down.
If it did go down, it wouldn't go down that much because you have, you know, you trade oil, you trade.
You got to sell and buy, right? So if it's a, yeah, and I, you know, I'm not knowledgeable enough. I'm not an economist to have a sense of how that stuff works. But I do know, you know, one of the issues why New York is kind of behind the eight ball right now is whatever their revenue stream that they get off of, you know, that whole New York Stock Exchange securities infrastructure in New York there, that's down right now. So,
but shall we say the Board of Trade, they've went up 1 million plus trades, all I know, sir, and that would be a good cash cow because there's only 25% of the farmers in Illinois trade, so 75% of them are some other place, and a lot of them are funds and don't care. And if you traded transaction of 5,000 bushel grain, that's two ten thousandths of a cent per bushel. That's mighty thin. And I don't think that's going to hurt any broker or anybody else. Thank you and good day.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll go on here to another caller. This is someone in Montgomery, Illinois. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know what? I disagree with you on the tax bit. I think we're all being taxed to death. And you're right in a sense, too. The fact of the matter is we've got a lot of people out there wanting a lot of these special, you know, little projects out there, and that's the part of the problem. I'll never understand why Illinois doesn't have, like, what California does for property taxes is like a Proposition 13. It worked out there, and it's still working, some kind of tax cap. The other thing would be, you know, clarity in just in the budget in general, because it's frustrating. You know, I understand that there's certain projects that people ought to be, you know, that we need out there for poor people. But the problem is the American public now, the middle guy is being forced out. I mean, I'm middle income, but I'm turning into lower middle income because I'm being taxed to death. I can't put money in the bank. I can't put money anywhere, but guess where my checks are going? 99% of it's going to paying taxes. You know, so do you think that's fair? I mean, I'm not asking the government for anything, but they're asking us for something. And I think it's gotten way and above overhand, out of hand. I think there needs to be some clarity. There needs to be some accountability. After all, the public didn't get us in this mess. It was the government themselves, whether it be city, county, state, because everybody's asking for it. It isn't just, it's the state wants some money, the county wants some money, the city you live in wants some money. How far do you want to go? Somebody has to take some responsibility here, and the public, Joe, is tired of it. I'm tired of it. You can tell I'm frustrated. I mean, I've talked to my congressmen, I've talked to my senators, I've talked to my local guys, and they all give me the runaround. You know, when you're lucky, you get them. You know, this is where we need a third party. I firmly believe this. If we'd have a third party in this state and in this country, maybe things wouldn't be so bad. But this country is going, it's spiraling downward. And you can't tell me that every time there's a tax, that's supposed to help us. Nah, it doesn't. It goes the other direction. It's $4, over $4 for a gallon for gas. Where do you think the money's going to come from, the average Joe? Because I don't got it. It's like sucking blood out of a tournament. I'll get off and listen. All right. Thank you. You guys have a great weekend.
Well, thanks for the call.
I
certainly hope that he's not paying 99% of his wages in taxes. But
it could be 99% of, you know, discretionary money that's left over. But he mentioned the property tax and Prop 13 in California. I do public opinion surveys, and you ask people, you know, you can't ask them what's your favorite tax, but, you know, what's the worst tax is how we phrase it. And the property tax tops the charts. And, you know, when we hear a lot of the public hostility taxation, the property tax is maybe the source of a lot of it, in part because, you know, you pay it in a lump sum check. It goes up even if the rate's not raised, if your housing values are going up, as they have been up until just the last year or so, pretty rapidly. And that, you know, that's really led to political crises in lots of states, is that you have people perceiving to be taxed out of their homes or actually, you know, facing increases in their property taxes that could conceivably tax them out of their homes. And government may be a little slower to respond to that. That's how California has ended up being done by a citizen initiative in Washington and Colorado and Oregon and these other states. But that one just sort of points out the constraints on government when it comes to using taxes as another source of revenue, that you literally get a revolution, if you want to call it that, at the ballot box, particularly around the property tax thing. Now, whether that's actually worked in California or not, we think it might have actually, since property tax is primarily a local source of revenue, it's kind of dried up some revenue for local school districts, forced the state to then raise more revenue to bail out some of these districts. So, you know, that can come back to bite people. But as far as what you feel when you're paying your taxes, you know, your income tax comes out of your paycheck just piece by piece, and then they give you money back at the end that they'd already taken from you. Your sales tax comes out kind of at every point of sale. Maybe you don't notice it as much. But that property tax is the thing that really, really gets people riled up.
Yeah. Let me just, before going on to some other callers, there's something I was interested in getting your thoughts on. You talked a little bit earlier about things that the federal government might do to ease the state budget situation and suggested that, you know, it might, for state budgets, it might be a better thing than rather than sending each taxpayer at $600 that they send it to their home state government. But I wonder if there are some things that actually the federal government might do that would make state budget situations worse. And I guess the one thing that I'm thinking about, and there's been a lot of discussion of recently, is for a summertime suspension of the federal gas tax. That apparently could cost states tens of millions of dollars and maybe not save consumers very much. Are there other things that go on at the federal level that have significant impact on the budget of states?
Certainly, yeah. The whole concept of mandates for federal standards of programs that are administered by the states that don't come with money. You know, anything from having to do land, you know, every project that's built has to meet certain environmental standards or studies that have to be done to prove things or somehow complying with federal laws or updating buildings to be, you know, with standards to federal laws or the health programs that are partly funded by the states coming with mandates that those impose costs on states that, you know, you'll often hear states grumbling about, or, you know, for border states bearing the cost of a lot of things that just have to be, you know, dealing with security and immigration stuff on the borders. You know, you've got those states' governors lobbying the federal government to help share those costs that they feel should be federal. But yeah, as far as the gas tax, I mean, I haven't heard a single economist say anything positive about the gas tax, so I can't believe that would actually be done. What I was commenting on is, you know, if your goal is macroeconomic stabilization in a downturn, that's a good time for these, you know, one-off, either the government takes on a bigger share of those things that they share, or they, you know, somehow just provide direct grants to the states to help them out. That, you know, because, you know, the flip side is when the recession ends, the federal government actually, the revenues for the federal government tend to recover quicker than the state's revenues. There's a lag for some of these states, and they are the ones who then have all the kind of increased social service costs associated with the recession that kind of drags it out longer in some states. So the federal government's in a better position to kind of do that stabilization role.
All right, let's talk with someone in Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a two-part question. The first part has to do with the gasoline tax that you just mentioned. I'm kind of skeptical when I see the politicians, complain about high gas prices, but because isn't it true that with these high doubling of the gas prices in recent years, it's amounted to a huge tax increase both on the state and federal level, and it's really what's keeping some states solvent. It seems I almost feel that it's high gas prices are almost, I think, coming from government policy more than anything else, because they really need that money and they're using it to meet some of their budget deficits. Would I be wrong in saying that?
I think a lot of states it's a fixed, you know, number of pennies per gallon, not a percentage of the price, which would mean if the price goes up, your government, your state, or your federal government is still getting their 25 cents or their 10 cents or whatever for gallon. If it was a percentage, that would probably be the case. But at least up until this recent discussion about suspending the gas tax, one of the worries for the federal government, I think some states too, that the price of gas was leading people to drive less. So revenues, you know, these are dedicated revenues into transportation budgets, were actually going down. They weren't making more money as people drove less.
Well, I had a different understanding of that. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some that are a percentage of it, but at least, you know, in the places where you've just, you know, you've got a fixed number of pennies per gallon that the state's bringing in, the more gas costs, it's not going to bring any more money for the state. And then if people start driving, the revenues, your transportation fund revenues would actually be going down if the price of gas makes people drive less.
I see. And the second part of my question had to do with the gambling. In Illinois, we seem time and again where politicians, I mean, you actually have people on both sides of the political spectrum who are opposed to gambling increase, both the liberals, conservatives, you know, pro-family groups on the right, and, you know, groups, you know, other groups on the left. And it seems the politicians keep trying to push this as a way to raise more revenues. And to me, it seems it actually ends up costing the state more in terms of social services and, you know, the problems caused by gambling. And I'm just wondering if, you know, what your opinion is on that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I forgot to bring that one up when we talk about some of the creative, if you want to call it that, sources of revenues that states look for in these kind of times. Lotteries, you know, this was the big, I don't want to call it a gimmick, but the painless revenue source that was pitched to states in the 90s. And you know, now it's, you know, how much do you expand casino gambling? How much do you expand slot machine gaming? Or, I'm sorry, it's been rebranded as gaming instead of gambling now by the industry lobbyists. You know, regardless of the kind of moral judgment on that, one thing that I think is showing in some states, at least with lotteries, is you can keep, you know, trying to plan on increasing revenues from these things, but they really don't bring in enough. You know, it's a couple percent maybe of a state's revenues, and the market kind of seems saturated, that, you know, they're flattened out. And then as far as a revenue source, again, regardless of all the kind of the moral issues associated with this and the social consequences of it, it's an incredibly expensive program to administer. I mean, collecting the cost of actually collecting the revenues and the administration and all this stuff is pretty high. So it's an inefficient way to raise revenues. It's probably, you know, kind of maxing out as a source of revenues, but that doesn't mean that governments aren't going to try to do it, because again, it's like, it's one of these, you know, it's easier than raising general taxes.
Yes. Thank you for your answer.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Todd Donovan. He's professor of political science at Western Washington University, Bellingham, Washington, and is interested in state politics. And we're talking about state budgets and some of the difficulties that states are facing across the country. The number here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next to someone in Urbana, here where we are, line 3. Hello.
Very briefly, Proposition 13. California once had the finest educational public educational system in the country. I believe it now is down in the lowest quarter, isn't it?
You know, it depends on how you count the money. If you look at spending per pupil, I think they score fairly low. If you just look at the actual amount of money spent on K-12 education, they bounced around a little since 1978, but they haven't really changed, and how you interpret that is kind of loaded. But the public universities in California are still regarded as strong as ever, but they've really shifted the cost of who's paying for those away from the state to the people that attend them.
I understood that test scores had fallen substantially.
Yeah, okay, so now they're, if you look at it in terms of those measures, Prop 13 gets blamed for a lot, and I think it has caused a lot of problems there. But the state has changed so fundamentally that, you know, the type of students that you get there, recent immigrants, children of immigrants, non-English speaking, less affluent. So by some of the performance measures, those have gone down. But at the same time, you know, the challenges to achieve the same level of success that you would have had in before 1978 is just a completely different demographic. So, you know, they're still spending a lot of money. Prop 13 has really kind of wreaked havoc on how that money's raised, but you know, there are other large forces at work there. That you know, the defense industry left California in the 80s. That, you know, that recession was blamed on Proposition 13. it had as much to do with just the reshaping of the global economy as it did have Prop 13. So yeah, Prop 13 has been an issue, and there's gross inequities across districts in California that result from this property tax stuff.
But in Illinois.
Yeah, and that stuff existed before Proposition 13. It's maybe been exasperated by it, but it's fine. I was just working on a study looking at the effects of Prop 13 recently, and one of the criticisms of what we said, they're still spending about as much, but they're not necessarily spending as much per pupil in the classroom. So that raises other questions then of what is it about the spending patterns of money that's been going through K-12? But it's a much more challenging environment than it was in 1978
compared to Europe. I believe the United States has one of the lowest tax rates overall of any country in the industrialized world. Am I right in that?
Yeah, if you look at the federal government, certainly it does. If you add in state and local governments, we get a little closer to Europe, but certainly, yeah, we have less. The public sector takes less of a share of gross domestic product in the United States than I would get in most advanced industrial countries in Europe.
Thank you. I think this is a very balanced and well-informed discussion you're giving, and I'm happy to hear it.
All right,
bye.
Well, thank you. I guess just to add to that, I think we also have to say, sure, we feel the pinch of taxes, but in fact, the state of Illinois, it, relatively speaking, is a low-tax state.
Yeah, I think it has issues in terms of it's one of the more regressive tax structures, at least it was in the last decade or so. But yes, the high tax states, again, this kind of gets to the public preferences in the states. If you look at Massachusetts or New York as being among the higher tax states, that tends to mesh up with the political climate of the states. The lower tax states are more conservative and there's less public support for taxes, and over time that stuff kind of plays to where public preferences are.
Yeah. Another caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Back to the gas tax. Do you have any idea how many states might be considering some kind of tax abatement, temporary abatement on state gas taxes?
I don't. And I was just looking at this for what happened this year. There were actually some that raised the gas tax. I think for 2008, Arkansas raised it by 6 cents. There were two states that increased it in 2008, as prices were going up. But I don't know what the plans are for 2009. From the anecdotes that I've seen, there's not a lot of support for any kind of gas holiday or limiting it. And the other thing we got to remember is a lot of these states, your tax, your federal tax and your state tax on that gas is a really small proportion of the $4 or whatever that it's going. But I think in this kind of climate, it's going to be hard for any states to be looking, or too many of them looking at lowering it.
Yeah, well, I know they were debating that in the House earlier this week. But judging by gas prices, I don't think anything's happened yet.
Yeah, and
they did it before. I mean, several years ago, they dropped it temporarily. But I think part of the problem with that is that even if you were to drop it, almost certainly the oil companies would raise the price up anyway. So it seems it would be a great way for the states to lose money that they really can't afford to lose at this point.
Yeah, I think that's in this climate, any tax cut is hard. But again, getting back to in more conservative anti-tax political climates, you're going to see tax cuts proposed. I'm not sure it'd be a gas tax cut, but there's property tax cuts being proposed in some states.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And over to Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Yes, you briefly mentioned early that you thought one state was going to try to tax marijuana. It seems to me there is a great spot that we already put people in jail for. Why not change it and just, there's so much money there. My God, that sounds like a fabulous thing if we just get past the moral aspects of it.
Yeah, I mentioned Minnesota, and I wish I knew more about this. It's actually, it's something that was done and has been on the books, where rather than in some sort of legalization program, it was, I don't think it was part of a decriminalization. It may have been part of a decriminalization thing, but there was, if you were caught in possession, you could be taxed the value of what you're in possession of. So it wasn't part of a complete decriminalization legalization thing. But that would, it's just, in a way, this kind of gets back to the California tax on pornography. It is a huge industry. It's a huge tax source. It'd be interesting to look at British Columbia. This is said to be, just north of me. Five 10% of the gross domestic product of the province comes out of growing marijuana. And, you know, at some point, there's no way you can't tax that. And, but again, it gets to the political climate and the political will.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, we've talked about states trying to do a number of things, put together enough pieces so that they can limp along until things hopefully get better, and they take advantage of any one-time sources of revenue. They don't put money into their pension funds. They go into their emergency funds. They may indeed try to find ways to raise taxes and fees so that the smallest number of people will be affected. Are there many places where, though, state governments are thinking about selling off significant state assets? Things, for example, there have been states here, I think even the state of Illinois, they've been talk of selling the state lottery, selling highway systems, selling buildings. It seems a little short-sighted because that's a one-time infusion of cash, but how to what extent are states thinking about doing that?
Yeah, I can't speak specifically about those. I mean, at least since 1980, local governments in particular and some state governments have been, you know, if possible, looking to what can be privatized, what services or maintenance operations and such can be privatized. The big thing you see, I mean, the only thing I think you'd see systematically across the states right now that sort of taps into that is toll roads. That, you know, and when it becomes increasingly difficult to raise transportation funds through gas taxes and things like that, that becomes, you know, more of an option, no longer a third rail. You know, a lot of states that don't have toll roads are now entertaining the idea of that. Which, you know, it's not quite, I don't know if you call that privatizing or selling off the roads or whatever, but there's definitely some movement in that direction.
Mm. Well, we're down to the point where we have to finish up. I guess overall, the picture here for currently there are states that are struggling, and there are an awful lot of states that say they have real concerns for the coming fiscal year, the one that for most states begins on the 1st of July. So it doesn't seem like things are going to get any easier anytime soon.
Based on current projections, I mean, and, you know, if there is some huge turnaround in the middle of 2009 after the fiscal year starts, revenue forecasts are changing. And, you know, that's what everybody's looking at for the months to come is what are these state revenue forecasts showing. Right now they're not, in most states, they're not showing anything very positive.
And as we said before, that you have to, when you're looking at states, obviously you have to say every state is different. So you go from one place to the next, their problems are different, their solutions are different, and not all states are hurting. This, as we said before, there are some states that are doing okay, particularly those that have big energy resources in their states. But it also doesn't sound as if that there's anybody who has, you couldn't really point to any one place as saying that they have some sort of spectacular new ideas or that they are brilliant in the way that they handle their accounting and their budgets. There's nobody who is some sort of a standout example for how it is you deal with times like this.
No, I think it's everybody, you know, the unique conditions of your state and how you get hit by these bigger economic forces. I mean, you can't just go out and drill for oil in Illinois and be the Alaska model, right? A lot of this is just driven by previous decisions made years, decades before. But, 10 years from now, whenever this recession's over, there'll be governors and legislators taking credit for their surpluses and their balanced budgets and all these great things that they did. And likewise, it has much more to do just with, you know, how your state's affected by larger economic forces.
Well, there we got to finish up. Our guest is Todd Donovan. He's professor of political science, Western Washington University, Bellingham, Washington. Professor Donovan, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
Support for this show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. And that's it for us here on Focus. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Now we'll turn things over to Jay Pierce.
Well, thank you very much, David, and we'll take a look at the market update in just a sec, and then the regular noon hour of news and information for a Friday ahead of a long weekend, big travel weekend. Meteorologist Ed Keisher will be in at 12:40 to take your phone calls and talk to Ed. You can get a custom forecast for wherever you might be headed, whatever you might have planned. As we begin the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL, AM 580 and will.illinois.edu. First, a look at wheat in Kansas City. The July contract at $8.50 is down a quarter. September at $8.12.50 is down 1.5. July wheat in Chicago, $7.49, up 4. September, $7.58.25, down 2. And December at $7.84, up 2. July corn, $5.99.50, up 3.75. September, $6.12.50, and that's up 4. And December at $6.28, up 3.75. July soybeans, $13.66, up 41.25. August at $13.70, up 41.75. September, $13.58, up 33.75.